What's up, sports fans? Welcome to another episode of Sports Odds and Ends, the show for the fly-by-night sports fan. I'm your host, King Cash, joined as always by my good friend and co-host, the one, the great, JVZ. What's up, my guy?
We had a good decade, Kaz. Entire decade of the Lakers not being NBA champions. And that's probably about as long as that will last ever. Because I think I saw a crazy stat that was like every presidential administration for dating back to the 1940s, back to the Truman administration, has seen the LA Lakers in the NBA finals. Now they've won again. They are champions. It is their 17th title, tying them for most all time.
Let's go through the accolades for the Lakers. So 17th title all time. For the players as individuals, this is LeBron's fourth finals MVP.
Which means J.R. Smith is not the finals MVP, which means you do not have to buy a Knicks jersey. So yeah. Some good news came out of this.
A lot of firsts. So first for the coach, Frank Vogel, Anthony Davis, Dwight Howard, Alex Kuzma, a lot of firsts on this team. Kind of some of the interesting is the back-to-back for Danny Green. I think that's always kind of interesting when a guy kind of is a role player who moves around and is just kind of able to find his way onto these teams that are in that progression to winning.
Like Patrick McCaw from 3 years leading up to this for two different teams. And then I guess Quinn Cook for the Warriors and now for the Lakers. Quinn Cook, who accidentally got left off the team bus when the bus drove back to Disney World. JaVale McGee also with the three-time champion now, JaVale McGee.
I did not realize that until it was written here in front of me that JaVale McGee has three rings. And I literally had to go, I was like, that's impossible.
He has one less than Shaq, who makes fun of him relentlessly. So,
yeah.
I would like to see him get that fourth one. Maybe not with the Lakers, but that'd be pretty funny if they both ended up with the same number of championships. J.R. Smith with two of them now. Rode LeBron's coattails for both of them.
Of course.
Rajon Rondo has one for both the Celtics and the Lakers, who are the two tied with 17 titles and the two storied franchises who are bitter rivals with each other. Also it being LeBron's 10th NBA finals appearance, that was, if he was a team, he would be fourth all time just in that category alone. So, I think there's been a lot of talk about LeBron's legacy after this, and we're not going to get into that LeBron versus Jordan debate, because you can find that literally anywhere else.
I just don't think it's a that big of a debate. I think it's more interesting to compare LeBron to Kobe or things like that. I don't really ever find it fair to compare LeBron to Jordan. That's just me. That's just how I feel about it.
Yeah, and I feel like the Magic Johnson comparison is a good one. So look into that one if you feel like it. Look into cross sport stuff, because I think like LeBron versus Gretzky and like the way they've won or the way they've done things on different teams and been productive for different teams, I think that's kind of cool.
Yeah. There are just better discussions to have than the Michael Jordan one. Some other news around the basketball sphere is Tyronn Lue is going to be the new coach for the Clippers after they parted ways with
Doc Rivers.
I could not remember his name. That's how bad he was. No, Doc Rivers is a pretty good coach. Yeah. But we're going to have a new look Clippers with Tyronn Lue and Chauncey Billups as the assistant.
Lue is actually Rivers' lead assistant for the last season. But I think the idea, or at least the hope, is that he's going to hold his players a little bit more accountable, because he was kind of able to do that when he won a championship in Cleveland with LeBron.
Yeah, where he was the assistant coach there.
Yeah, before he was then. Yeah.
Look, wherever LeBron goes, he's the coach. We know that.
Well, now he's in the same city, at least, if not for the same team.
And I mean, the Clippers are in a position right now where they want to win. That's the position they are currently in. That's what they are looking at. That's kind of how they feel. They want to win. They want to win right now. They went out and they spent the money. They got Kawhi Leonard. They have
Paul George.
They have Paul George at the moment, who there's also a lot of talks about them moving Paul George, but they have Paul George at the moment. That's what that roster is. That's their big two, and they're looking to kind of move around that.
They might only have a year to do this as well, if both of those guys get upset and leave after next year. So it's that's when the contracts run up, and then they owe the Oklahoma City Thunder a bunch of draft picks after that.
Yep. All right, so let's kind of move into something a little meaty. We got some baseball news. We have some advances in these baseball playoffs that we've been talking about. So Tampa Bay has advanced into the World Series game after almost throwing, literally, that game. But they were able to hold it out.
Yeah, it was really close there for a second. And I was worried that we were going to have to deal with the Astros players, who have been probably the most smug out of all this, being able to boast that they came back from a 3-0 lead on top of, you know, being as defiant as they have been over their whole cheating scandal. But I think this shut them up for good. So at least we don't have to deal with that team until next year. Hopefully fans remember by the time they're at least more of them are in the stands for games next year. Hopefully they remember to boo. On the other side, the National League side, Dodgers and Braves has gone to 7 games, and the 7th game will be tonight.
All right. I'm gonna do it before DJM does it. Hot seat. We're on the clock, boys. Go around the horn. Who do you got? Dodgers, Braves? Starting with me, I'm going to take the Dodgers.
I will, too, because I feel like they have to make up for. I mean, they shouldn't have to make up for it, but I feel like they're owed a championship.
Mm-hmm. DJ?
I want to see Clayton Kershaw finally get his ring and shut up the haters, so I'll go with the Dodgers.
All right, there it is, ladies and gentlemen. That's the 3 for the Dodgers. If we're all wrong, that's going to look bad on our, our prediction charts. No, it wouldn't. All right, a little bit of football news, a little bit of sad news, a little bit of questioning, all in one story. Dak Prescott unfortunately suffered an injury in his game against the Giants last week, fractured a bone in his ankle. It looked really, really bad. Unfortunately,
on the scale of like Paul George, Gordon Hayward, Alex Smith type bad.
Yeah.
It turned out to not be as bad as Alex Smith's as far as being life threatening. It's that kind of break in his ankle where like you can see the leg turn multiple directions and
it's one of those things. It's like with all those ones you named, right? It's such an unfortunate thing on almost a very innocuous play, right? It's just him fighting a defender and a defender fighting to bring him down. Yeah. And they just kind of get tripped up into each other and just a really unfortunate thing happened. Yeah. So right now the way it's looking is he's going to be out 4 to 6 months. I think the big discussion that a lot of people are having, especially a lot of people in Twitter, a lot of people around the league, a lot of people in other podcasts, are the fact that this was kind of a money year for Dak Prescott. Yeah. he was looking to earn a bigger contract because he held out prior to this year in which they put a franchise tag on him, and he was looking to get paid. So now we're in this situation, and we've seen it before go multiple ways. We've seen it before where teams will hold this against the guy and not pay him, and we've seen it where teams kind of have the heart to be like, you know what, that was our guy, that is our guy, and that will continue to be our guy if he comes back healthy. So it's a rough situation. Everybody wants to see Dallas pay him. I would like to see Dallas pay him. I think he's earned it for the most part. I mean, they haven't been the most exceptional team that I think they want to be, but I think that's in other places. I don't think it's at QB that they are not a good team.
Yeah, and I guess the question has never been whether he is a quarterback, like a good quarterback or not. It's whether he deserves maybe the Patrick Mahomes type money that he thought he should get. And this year he bet on himself, and he's been productive enough to where you could say that he's made good on that bet up until this point where he got injured. So yeah, at this point the Cowboys can either just say we're not going to pay you at all next year because you're coming off a broken leg, or they could franchise tag him again, which would pay him nearly $38 million for a single season, fully guaranteed. He's being paid 31 this year, I think. Or they could try to work out a long term deal, which they haven't been able to do so far, which is why they've had to do the franchise tags. So I think at least now, like, the franchise tag is kind of the middle ground in the negotiation. And I feel like if they do that, then that doesn't stop them from negotiating the long-term deal. But yeah, if they do if they at least say, we're not going to just immediately cut you after an injury, then I feel like that is enough to at least earn enough goodwill to keep the discussion going. Yeah, and then because if they do just completely walk away from this is going to look really bad for them. But this does put them in a position, I mean, in callously talking about it from just a pure negotiation, this does put them in a position to evaluate how Andy Dalton is going to do leading the team for most of the season, and decide whether they want to move forward or not with Dak Prescott, which I don't know. I feel bad saying that because, you know, I watched this man cry as he was getting carted off the field last Sunday, and you know, just the outpouring of support for him has been tremendous, and he's been super positive about, you know, a really tough situation. But yeah, this is kind of this is why, you know, sometimes you should just take the money that's on the table. You know, he was fighting for more guaranteed money and fewer years on the contract. So I think, you know, maybe some of that changes a little bit after an injury like this, which doesn't seem to be career threatening. So at least that scare is kind of out of the way. And there's a good chance where if the Cowboys don't offer him the kind of money he wants, there's another team out there that probably will. So financially, I think Dak Prescott will be okay no matter what. And okay means he gets what he wants financially. Not that, you know, he's going to starve or anything like that. I think this wait and see just took a pretty dark turn. But
yeah. All right. So let's kind of tackle these other things real quick. Le'Veon Bell was cut from the team he was with, and then was kind of immediately, pretty quickly, signed by the Chiefs. So that's a really, really, really interesting drop in pick I think.
Yeah. I don't like how you just didn't even acknowledge the Jets.
The who? No. I mean, I think the Jets at this moment, being currently 0-5, are probably in the midst of thinking that they need to rethink their lineups, which is why this is probably happening. And I'm probably, I'm going to say I'm like 60, 70% sure we're going to see the Jets either trading or letting go more people and looking to just kind of take this and restructure from here.
Yeah. And Bell and Adam Gase did not get along either. I think kind of the situation with Dak Prescott, Le'Veon Bell was in that situation a couple of years ago with the Steelers, and he chose basically to sit out a year and then sign with the Jets for at least a level of guaranteed money that was acceptable. They basically, I think, got paid $28 million for, I want to say, 14 games.
Mm-hmm.
And then he signed with the Chiefs here for close to a minimum deal, but also with some incentives as well. So it's, you know, you went from basically the worst team in football to maybe the best.
Yeah.
I guess that's good for him.
That is a glow up. As they say.
Yeah. Fun trivia question for you, Kaz. Do you know who the last home team to win in MetLife Stadium and when that was?
When the last home team to win was, I think it was the Jets, right?
It was the New York Guardians XFL football team.
Oh my God.
in early 2020. So,
because the Giants haven't, neither one of them have done
won
anything
a game this year.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, God. Yeah. And the Giants are entering that sphere where they really disappoint you. I think there's some stat that the last few times they've had a double digit lead, they've lost that game. Like anytime they've had a double digit lead, they've lost that game. So they're just, I don't know what it is, man. Like, I don't know what it is, what we're doing. That team is just bad. So, yeah. All right. Speaking of Adam Gase, that is, so hold on. Let me roll that back. We have a firing. We have another one who was kind of, we put him on the hot seat and he was immediately fired. So Atlanta has fired their head coach, Dan Quinn. Atlanta has been looking pretty bad. So Dan Quinn was immediately fired. And I think kind of this now puts a lot of pressure on Matt Ryan. I think Matt Ryan is now on the hot seat. I think, for the most part, Atlanta still believes in Matt Ryan. It's his, I think, 13th or 14th season as an NFL quarterback. But they are also going to start to look a little bit more in depth and look at their options and see what they can do. Because I think once you fire your head coach, if you do believe in your team, as you move on from there, if you're still not seeing the things you want, and you're not firing any other front office people, you start to look at the field. And I think one of the big glaring things is Matt Ryan. He's been kind of rangy. He's had good games. He's had really, really, really bad games. And it's just kind of one of those things where you just start to look around and point fingers. So I think that's where Atlanta is right now.
Yeah. I think Matt Ryan and Matt Stafford were drafted in the same year, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, like the last time we talked about the Lions with DJM, it was like, you know, Matt Stafford is not the problem. So I kind of feel the same way about Matt Ryan.
Mm-hmm.
Matt Ryan is not the problem there. I think, I think Dan Quinn was partly the problem. Like, the offense has not really been the problem that much either. It's been the defense not being able to hold double-digit leads again. And I think that's like a common theme for some of the coaches that have been that are kind of on the hot seat this year. It's not so much
the
quality of the coaching or the quality of the team. It's just the ability to make good decisions and hold leads because there's talent on the team. There's and that talent has been coached up and built up. You know, Dan Quinn took this team to a Super Bowl and nearly won it had they not thrown a 28-3 lead. So I think it's kind of a matter of decision making, and they probably would have had another win this year had they figured out how to recover an onside kick. So it's just like little things like that, that you can point the finger at the coach at that point. Even though like the players have some blame to play and all that too, it's maybe on the coach to try to remind them of certain things. And it hasn't worked out for Dan Quinn. But I guess he had a good run. The other two coaches that are on our hot seat are Adam Gase and Matt Patricia, who have not had a good run at all.
So those would be the next couple of names to look out for. I think, especially with the kind of the downfall of the Giants and the Jets, especially for the Giants, who have been looking to have kind of a breakout year in the past 5 years and haven't hit one yet. There's probably going to start to be some names getting looked at there as well. All right, so let's kind of move on to the meat of the week. So this is the thing. The writing was on the wall, right? We've been talking about this for a while.
I think DJ might have been the first to call it, but
yeah. So it finally happened. Daryl Morey has stepped down from his position at the Houston Rockets.
According to him, it was like he's tired. He wants to spend time with family.
Wasn't
that involved in the head coaching search. So
let's just put this out here straight up and down. Is this a forced mutual parting of ways, or do we think this is real? Because that's the big question.
I think he knew he was going to be forced out within a year from now. I don't think he necessarily saw that pressure yet. I believe him when he says that. But I do believe that, like, maybe he wasn't entirely happy with how things have gone recently, not just because of, you know, the China stuff, but with the way the team is shaped now. And it kind of looks like the Rockets have hit their peak. There's reports that Russell Westbrook trade, which has kind of been a disaster for them, was not his idea. That was kind of forced on him by ownership. On top of that, his lead assistant is now gone. His head coach is now gone. He's not really into it anymore.
Is now with Minnesota. Monte McNair is over in Sacramento.
Whoop, whoop.
Sam Hinkie is doing something in Philly.
He's not there anymore, and he's blackballed. He's not getting a job anywhere else.
In the shadow realm. Like you said, DJM was one of the kind of the big proponents on this. How do you feel about this?
I think that this is making something larger out of something that is probably not nearly as big or transformative as maybe it's being made out to be. Daryl Morey's plan, along with Mike D'Antoni, just didn't work. That style of basketball had a ceiling, and it only got them so far. And I think that the writing was on the wall. In the Western Conference is getting tougher and tougher, And the Houston Rockets are in need of readjustment, and Daryl Morey wasn't the guy.
Okay. Moving on from there.
His assistant, Raphael Stone, is the guy who's taking over. So I guess they don't have to go search for another GM at this point while they're in the middle of searching for a head coach. So, real transition period for the Rockets.
So obviously there's a lot of front office changes for the Rockets, right? That's what we're looking at here. Do you think once that is settled, do you think we're looking at a team that's going to get blown up?
I mean, we've talked about this a little bit before, but it's kind of hard to blow this team up because that means finding a trade partner that is willing to take Russell Westbrook or finding somebody that's willing to take. I don't think they're going to trade James Harden. I think at this point it's ride or die with James Harden. Mm-hmm. And he's just been such a fundamental part. Like if he decides he wants to go somewhere else, they will oblige. But I just don't think they get rid of him at this point because there's no real upside other than start the rebuild earlier, which doesn't really help them because they owe all their draft picks to the Oklahoma City Thunder. They're in a tough position where they have to win now, but they don't have the pieces to win now, and they don't really have the pieces to get better. And I think that's part of what Daryl Morey sees on the wall, and probably why now is a good time to leave before he gets blamed for everything.
Yeah,
and they force him out at the same time using that as a reason to get rid of him for to maybe make China happy. Even though it seems like they're kind of over the whole thing, and they're broadcasting NBA games again, and there's a lot of articles about there out there being kind of an end of an era. You know, all those assistants that we named, it's kind of like the Daryl Morey general management tree. Like you kind of have coaching trees and stuff. He's had a tremendous influence around the league as a bit of an analytics pioneer. So now it kind of went to the point where this was something he was heavily pushing. And now it's a part of every front office around the league where if you're not doing something analytic based, then you're just so far behind everybody else. Even if you don't dive as headfirst into it as Daryl Morey did, or focus on the same things that Daryl Morey focused on, still kind of that mark. He obviously wasn't the only one, but he was a strong proponent of it. It's an end of an era, 13 years with that team. So,
I think my last question then on the Rockets is, does this team still have life in it, or is this going to be a team that we watch just kind of fall off?
I think this is a team that we'll be watching make first and second round exits for the next 3 or 4 years.
I kind of really agree.
And I don't think they have a whole lot of room to move in either direction. So it's, because it's like James Harden can drag this team to the playoffs by himself. Mm-hmm. He's just that effective of a scorer, that effective of a player. He doesn't get hurt very often. So I think like you'll see him around. And Russell Westbrook is productive, if not necessarily efficient in his productivity. There's just too much talent on this team to not make the playoffs. But that's not where they need to be if they want to get better. So they're kind of just stuck. End of an era. The story, we've kind of bundled it with this speculation still, but there's a report that Billy Beane might take an ownership stake in The Fenway Sports Group, which owns the Boston Red Sox and Liverpool Football Club, and I think a couple other teams, maybe a couple esports teams as well. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of a sports conglomerate at this point. So if he gets an ownership stake in that, then he has to leave the Oakland A's because of the conflict of interest. But Billy Beane is very famous for kind of being the star of Moneyball, and or being at least the focus of that book and the subsequent movie that was made from it, and known as kind of a pioneer in the baseball analytics world. But you know, the same thing as with Daryl Morey in basketball, like every baseball team now is using analytics. The Moneyball book kind of boils it down to like kind of something very simple as like focus on base percentage instead of focusing on batting average. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of that was the innovation at the time, but now everybody's done that. Everybody's doing that, and that's something that's not new to anybody anymore. It's been nearly two decades since the events of that book took place. So and Billy Beane has managed to be effective, you know, during this entire time. But you know, at the same time, like as I've been complaining about the Oakland A's, you know, last week and in previous weeks, they make the playoffs, and then once they get there, all bets are off. And so you know, neither Morey nor Billy Beane
VZ?
Won a championship. What's up?
Question for you. What do you think the Oakland A's in this era have missed on that would have gotten them over the top? You said that they get to the playoffs and then all bets are off. What do you think has held them back?
Money.
As in being overspenders or not spending?
Yeah, I would say non-spending. I mean, it's kind of a, I mean, it's since I was a kid, it's kind of been this trend where they find these, you know, gem players, both in the draft, and in free agency. And then, if they build themselves up to a point where they're deserving of a long-term contract, the kind of contract that you would see like a Clayton Kershaw get, or a kind of contract that you would see, like the Mookie Betts type contracts, maybe not that large, but you know, something along the lines of 5+ years and more than $20 million a year for those years. Like they haven't paid for those contracts. They've let the Yankees sign those guys. They've let they've let other the big spending teams that you know go out and get those guys and keep them long term. After they've been discovered and built up by the A's farm system. So, if you can keep that talent, then you don't have to, when you find more talent, that adds to your depth. I feel like they've just been content with being able to find that talent, and keep unearthing that talent, but not necessarily paying those guys to stick around. I think Chris Davis might be the guy with the longest tenure on the team. And I think there was talk a couple of years ago that he was, it may or may not be difficult to sign him to a long-term contract. And I think he's startled a bit, so maybe it's not going to be so hard to keep him, but it's just, people just know around here that, once an A's player becomes good, they're going to go, they're going to cash out and play the prime of their career with somebody else. And so if maybe one or two times, they can manage to get those guys to stick around long-term and play the prime of their careers in Oakland, then, maybe they could get.
Now,
past
is this on? Is this on ownership? Is this on the Oakland A's ownership, or is this the front office making these decisions just to let guys go? Or is this front? Or is this the ownership just saying, "No, we're not going to pay anybody ever"?
I always have a tendency to blame ownership. The excuse is that they are that Oakland is quote unquote a small market, but it really isn't. It's you know, sometimes the blame gets put on the fans a little bit, like, you know, the stadium's not that full and this and that, but I mean the fans will turn out for the important games around here, so I think that the Oakland A's are always near the bottom when it comes to spending. So at that point, you have to blame ownership for not being willing to spend. And this is a team that is known for doing more with less. Since as long as I've been in the area following the team, they've done more with less, and they've done a great job of doing more with less. You know, it would be nice to see what they could do with more. And I think that's, we've exhausted what they can do with less at this point. Billy Beane himself claims that the playoffs are kind of just random. And in a way, we've talked the last couple of weeks about how analytics, you know, there's plenty of data for what happens during the regular season. There's a ton of data for that. But in the playoffs, the strategies change, everything changes. So I guess making the playoffs has been just good enough for this team for a long time. And I guess that's not necessarily a bad thing. Very few teams make the playoffs in baseball. Although that number may increase over the next couple of years, but being one of the top 10 teams in baseball every year is not necessarily a bad thing, but it would be nice to see this team and this city get a chance to celebrate.
Just one more thing. Yeah. Do you think that the Oakland A's ownership sees them more as an option to generate revenue, as opposed to some owners who really care about winning? Do you think they see it that way?
I would lean towards yes. I mean, I honestly don't know a whole lot about the A's ownership, because they tend to be pretty quiet unless they're trying to negotiate with the city over a new stadium. I kind of feel that way about all baseball owners. It seems like, there's a couple teams where you can rely on them to be big spenders, but for the most part, I think, with the revenue sharing that they have, it's kind of hard to not turn a profit in American sports the way I see it. So anytime a team tries to cry poverty, I don't really believe it. If you are not spending to try to win a championship, then yeah, you're treating your team like it's just a money making vehicle. Just generating a small profit every year might just be good enough for some of these owners, and maybe the A's are in that group. They got to move out of like the basement when it comes to spending, for me to think otherwise. Move into the middle of the pack, move into the top 10 every once in a while. It takes going from spending $50 million a year to spending $100 million a year, and I think some of the top teams are doing like the $200 million range. I don't think that's a lot to ask, but I don't run the team. But yeah, you know, from some financial talk to other financial talk, I think COVID has given a bunch of sports leagues a chance to rethink their finances.
Yeah.
Some of them out of necessity, some of that because they, some of that out of necessity, some of it out of opportunity. Like I think this NWHL story is a situation of opportunity. The league is growing. And four out of the six teams were owned by a single group. And then two other teams were owned by individual entities. So now they're moving that. They're going to break up that single ownership group and
push for single ownership franchises, kind of basically, right?
Yeah. Like almost every other sports league. I think the XFL, I think we talked about that being like a single entity model before.
Mm-hmm.
The MLS is kind of a weird thing where like they have a bunch of individual ownership groups, but like the MLS as a single entity negotiates the contracts. So that's kind of weird, but yeah, pretty much every other league is, you know, you own one team and then everybody, you know, all the owners vote on things and that's what runs the league. So the NWHL is going to that model and that allows, you know, I think that kind of spreads the risk around a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And provides more places where individuals can invest if they want to. So if somebody is interested in investing in the league, they can, you know, maybe own a seventh team if they want to, or, you know, buy in to a smaller stake in a sixth team instead of owning trying to own a part of the entire league as a conglomerate. They can kind of invest in a single area, a single city. So I think it creates a little bit more flexibility for them moving forward. And I think it's kind of a sign that they are growing. So, so I think that's good for them. The NBA right now is trying to figure out, basically everything is kind of on hold, all the off-season transactions besides coaching hires and general manager hires. But no player movement can really happen until they figure out what to do with finances for next season. Players Association and the league have agreed to extend the deadline for negotiations until October 30th. But basically they know that they're going to suffer huge losses next season without fans in the stands. So,
yeah.
So they have to figure out what to do with the revenue split. Normally it's I think 49% of the revenue goes to the players. But if they want to keep the salary cap where it is now, they might need to adjust that a little bit. The reason why they don't want to, you know, drop the salary cap is teams have been planning for years based off of what they kind of expect the salary cap to be and expecting it to go up a little bit every year. And so if it were to go down suddenly, then anybody who's a free agent this year is now going to get a significantly smaller contract than they thought as every team tries to play the market a lot more cautious than they did before. And you know, ticket sales accounted for 40% of revenue. So this is not a small chunk of money that they're missing by not having fans. It's a pretty significant chunk.
Yeah.
They haven't said when the start of the season is going to be, but I think they're trying to delay it for as long as possible so that they can start getting fans into the stands for as much of the season as possible. But that all depends on the state of COVID in the United States. And we all know that that's, you know, there's nothing set in stone about that. The NBA draft itself is on November 18th. And that's when a lot of player transactions happen as teams kind of jostle around and trade for draft picks. And sometimes they end up trading players for picks and that affects team finances because you know, that affects who you have on your roster and how much you're paying those guys. So, yeah, so they have a lot to work out. But one thing that's kind of been very interesting coming out of the NBA bubble is just how confining everybody into the same area for several months has, you know, kind of made everybody, it's kind of given everybody a sense of camaraderie. And that's even down to like the negotiations between labor and ownership. Just having everybody there in one spot. The head of the Players Association, Michelle Roberts, I think she was intending on retiring before COVID happened, and she's kind of stuck around to kind of help guide the players through this process. But I think she entered the bubble halfway through, and she's been there. She intended on leaving shortly after that, but I think she just saw the opportunity that this is the first time she's been able to have access to all of the players for an extended period of time in one spot. And so she's, you know, developed a ton of relationships from that. She's developed, you know, she's strengthened her relationship with Commissioner Adam Silver. So I think, I think the NBA is in a very healthy position when it comes to the relationship between the players and the owners. And it wasn't always this smooth, but I feel like the last couple of years, players and owners have pretty much been, they've been very much in lockstep with each other and done a good job of working with each other and not been quite as adversarial as, say, baseball or football has been. So I'm confident that they'll be able to get something done before the draft, something that's kind of agreeable to everybody, because the players are probably going to have to take a bit of a loss on this in order to make this work. But it seems like they're open to it.
I think not having basketball for an extended period of time has affected how these decisions are going. And in a sense, I think a lot of it will affect a lot of these decisions for a lot of these sports. So it's going to be interesting to see the way these things go. I think the NCAA and the Premier League ones are going to be ones to kind of be interesting to see. But I don't, I just don't know what to really think of a lot of this. Like it's a lot of big changes that seem insignificant, but they are really, really big.
Yeah. They could, I mean, in the case of, NCAA Division One and the Premier and the English Premier League, it could have an effect on kind of competitive balance going forward. So at least this NCAA story, it's kind of just a survey for now, but yeah, there's a lot of dissatisfaction with the current model within Division One schools. And kind of there's conflicts between the entirety of Division One and then just the ones from the Power Five conferences. A lot of questions around revenue sharing and how money gets distributed from the NCAA men's basketball tournament, or how money gets distributed from college. From the college football playoffs, which are kind of the big money making things. Only 22% are satisfied with March Madness. 25% are satisfied with the college football playoffs. But interestingly enough, 62% believe that sports budgets should be capped, which I think if that were to happen, then we would see a lot less of the like really egregious stuff, like, you know, LSU spending a shit ton of money on their locker room for their football team and you know, no money on you know, upgrading, you know, fixing structural problems with their library. And so it would change recruiting a little bit, because they use those lavish expenses to try to recruit players. And so maybe it changes the balance of
since you can't pay people. You try to entice people with luxury and yeah. all these amenities. The kind of the same way hotels and that industry tries to entice people to come to their hotel as opposed to another, right? Like, we have nicer rooms, we have nicer this, we have nicer that. And less about the programs itself, right? Because it used to be about the program. It used to be about teaching you the intangibles of football. But when in this very, very athletic realm we live in, a lot of these guys who are good are kind of touted as good no matter what. And you have to entice them to come to your school somehow, some way. So you have these luxuries that the bigger schools can afford to try to entice these people. So
yeah. And so if more of that money were to get distributed around to some of these smaller schools, then that changes things and maybe gives some of the smaller schools more of an opportunity to make an impact, rather than just the same big powerhouse schools every time. This is kind of happening at the same time with the discussion of whether players should get paid a little bit. So if that were to happen, then that changes the financial model a little bit as well. We talk about how much money gets made, at least by the popular NCAA sports. And should the players get a chunk of that? And and on top of that, just everybody's dissatisfied with the enforcement policies, which I know, every time there's a story about like this school got penalized for this bullshit thing and this other school got penalized for this bullshit thing. Well, we all know that certain players are just getting paid under the table,
yeah,
and getting away with it, or they're routing money through apparel manufacturers and using them to pay the kids instead of paying them directly and all this other bullshit. So like, I think everybody's seeing that it's very clearly not working. There's a lot of dissatisfaction there. That all this is wait and see. And when it comes to the business of college sports in America, it's a very large business of wait and see. So, a lot of things can change and a lot of things can affect the athletes of tomorrow. For the English Premier League, this kind of caught everybody off guard. But Manchester United and Liverpool kind of negotiated two American owned teams, by the way, negotiated behind closed doors. And worked out this weird plan where they would cut the Premier League to 18 teams and then change the way that teams were promoted into the league. They scrapped scrapped the League Cup tournament and the Community Shield, which is the winner of the FA Cup and the Premier League every year would play each other. For just a charity game at the start of the season. But what they wanted to do was change the financial distribution model. Because right now when you qualify for the Premier League, you get like the amount of money you start making is significantly more than you would if you were in the Football League Championship, the one division below it. So now if you drop from the Premier League, you would normally lose a shit ton of incoming revenue when you make that drop. But there's a quote unquote parachute payment that gets paid to those teams that drop out of the Premier League to try to lessen that financial impact. And so that has kind of resulted in teams in the Football League Championship just going for broke and trying to go all out just to qualify for the Premier League for a season and then drop and collect those parachute payments because even collecting those parachute payments, you get significantly more money than you would otherwise, you know, if you were kind of a steady Football League championship team that rose up the ranks slowly. So the idea is to kind of smooth out the differences between what you would make in the Premier League versus what you would make in the Football League Championship versus League One versus League Two down below. And all of this while trying to negotiate rescue payments for the lower leagues. So just all of this talk. And then on top of that, trying to sneak in reducing voting rights to just 9 of the Premier League teams that have been there for a long time versus letting anybody who's in the Premier League vote on issues.
Yeah, which that's...
That's weird. Kind of the dirtiest part of this plan. Yeah. But yeah, they didn't talk about this with anybody as they negotiated this. So it was just kind of 2 of the top teams trying to talk this out and then coming up with a plan by themselves in secret and then revealing it to everybody. And everybody reacted pretty strongly to that.
As they should have.
Yeah. Politically, like, I mean, the UK government was not happy about this either. So that's how poorly this was received. And so I think everybody's kind of talked it out and agreed unanimously to not adopt this plan, but they did agree to a £50 million rescue package for League One and League Two. And I think everybody's acknowledged that something needs to change going forward regarding the financial structure, but this plan isn't it. So I think maybe we'll see something similar. I do think, you know, the issue of parachute payments and kind of the smoothing of the financial distribution model between the Premier League and the rest of the football leagues in England is going to need to change a little bit, because what's happening now has its own visible problems, but it's just interesting to see how the financial structure works a little bit differently in kind of the pyramid league system of, or like the ladder system that that is European soccer versus American sports, where they're just very closed. 30 teams, we decide who we let in and who we don't let in, and it's very socialistic and a lot more sharing in when it comes to American leagues, where it's very capitalistic in Europe and you know, kind of sink or swim, and kind of contrasting to the political and economical structures of the governments in both those areas. It's kind of flip-flopped. So yeah, like we said, wait and see on all of these financial stories. These are big long-term changes and a lot of discussion that has to happen before any of this changes. But COVID has kind of given both an opportunity to reform and an opportunity to exploit. And so we'll see what ends up winning out.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to some odds of the weekend. Joe Buck is going a mile, so to speak. He's going to be in the middle of a 13-game schedule in the next 13 days. So he's going to be calling the Braves and Dodgers for that playoff series.
Done with that.
Last
6 days. And this was originally advertised as Joe Buck is calling 7 games in 7 days, starting today, with the Bucks Packers football game. He had a Bills Chiefs game delayed from a couple weeks ago, so. More ripple effects from the NFL COVID scandal. Yep. That game was supposed to be his game from a couple weeks ago. That's been rescheduled to tomorrow, Monday night, which normally he doesn't call games on Monday night. And then since he's also a baseball announcer or kind of the lead Fox baseball play-by-play guy, he's doing World Series game 1 and 2 on Tuesday and Wednesday. than Thursday night football between the Giants and Eagles, and then games 3 and 4 of the World Series on Friday and Saturday. If there's a game 5, he will do the next day, Sunday. So that will be 8 games in a row. That was originally the plan, but he was also doing the NLCS games between the Braves and the Dodgers this week, which ended up going 7 games. So I think he might have been hoping to get a break in in there if that series were to have ended before 7 games, but it didn't. In fact, he's not able to call game 7 tonight because of his football obligations today. Although he has called a baseball and football game in the same day before, but both of them were in San Francisco, so he was actually able to ride the trolley.
I mean, he could just be the first guy to call two different games at the same time.
I mean, at this point, like, his schedule is getting that packed. So I don't know. Like, I'm okay with Joe Buck. I know a lot of people don't like him. And I think he gets more hate on the football side than I think he does on, I don't know. He seems to get a lot of hate on the baseball side as well, but I think some of the hate is just people thinking that he's biased against their team, which is, I don't know. I've never met a person who doesn't think the announcers are biased against their team, at least a national announcer.
It can also be one of those things where people just hear him a lot. And look at the schedule, right? The schedule kind of speaks for itself. It could just be one of those things where, especially in certain regions, you hear a person a lot. If you kind of fall into the same ilk as us on this podcast, where you do follow a lot of different sports, you kind of flip flop one way or the other, and maybe hearing the same person over and over just kind of, DJM puts it really, really brilliantly. I can't speak right.
Familiarity
now.
Breeds contempt.
And
I think, I mean, at one point he was growing up, at least in my early youth, he was just the baseball announcer, the Fox Saturday baseball guy, and the guy who would call World Series games for Fox. And but then he also, you know, Pat Summerall retired and John Madden left to go to ABC, I think, at the time. And and then so that kind of left an opening at the top, and Fox said, hey, why not get our lead baseball guy to do our football games as well? And so he's been doing that since then, and he's been partnered with Troy Aikman since then. And so people, I don't know, he's had a couple, maybe controversial calls. Mm-hmm. I think very famously, like the helmet catch that, you know, from the Giants Patriots Super Bowl game. I think he got criticized for being a little bit too bland for one of the most famous, you know, one of the most amazing plays that you will ever see in a Super Bowl. I don't know, anybody who criticizes him for being dry, I immediately feel like you don't remember his predecessor, because Pat Summerall was also very dry. But also, I don't mind dry announcers, because sometimes that's like, you know, sometimes announcers kind of just want to say a couple words and then let the crowd and let the visuals speak for themselves. So some people don't like that. Some people would rather have the announcers screaming at them and super excited all the time, which I get that sometimes too. But sometimes that gets to be distracting.
Yeah. I think when you have a singular entity, it's dependent, right? Who calls a lot of games. For me, I tend to like a flow. I tend to be more judgmental of duos than I do of a singular person. You know what I mean? Like I could think people are good individual commentators, but it's when you pair them up that I start to get judgmental of them. And I am kind of a stickler for a good duo who are calling a game. I love a good duo who can call a game. That is kind of what I feel like I was brought up on. So like, I don't know, Joe Buck as an individual, I think he's a good guy. I think he does really well at the things that he does. For me, it's I don't really pay attention to somebody until they're paired up with somebody else, and then that's when I'm more like, oh man, they were just kind of, there was nothing there for me.
So Kaz, mm-hmm. where do you stand on Joe Buck and Troy Aikman?
Joe Buck, Troy Aikman. So in that duo, I like Joe Buck. I don't like Troy Aikman. Right, Troy Aikman is like the weak link there for me, and it always stands out for me when I hear Troy Aikman with anyone. And like that's one of those things, right? That to me, Troy Aikman makes Joe Buck seem bad, but that's just because I don't like Troy Aikman.
And I think we do kind of get an advantage of hearing Joe Buck call baseball games, call football games. You get to see him paired up with other people besides just the same person every single time.
Now, Kaz, so. I'll ask you this one. What do you say to Joe Buck and John Smoltz?
I like both of those guys.
All right.
I do. I like that pair, having kind of drifted away from baseball and come back. I like that pairing a lot more than I like Joe Buck and Tim McCarver.
Tim McCarver, I'm not super familiar with. I've heard his name a few times. I know I've heard the voice, but I'm just not.
Yeah, super you didn't miss much with Joe Buck and Tim McCarver. You didn't miss much.
Yeah, but yeah, to me, Joe Buck seems like a guy that can do well with anybody, which is I think maybe why I don't give him as much hate as some other people like to do. So.
I think
he's kind of a guy that pisses everybody off equally. So he's going to be the guy that gets picked because otherwise everybody else, other than Tony Romo, I guess, who isn't a play by play guy. But, you know, I
somehow, some way, Tony Romo has just become like a god behind the desk.
Yeah, just everybody else gets hate. In some form or another, except for Tony Romo. So
yeah, it's so weird how Tony Romo has elevated from player to commentator. Like it's one of the weirdest transitions for me. Like I know it's a normal transition, but
literally the same transition Troy Aikman made.
Cowboys quarterback to his stock rose. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like it's usually your stock is going down, and his stock was kind of going down in football, but he probably could have played a few more years if he wanted to. But the fact that he was being like, you know, sought out after by teams and then by TV deals at the same time, where he got to make that decision for himself is really interesting to me.
I mean, Andy Dalton doesn't work out.
Yeah. all right, let's move on to some real oddities. Zamboni, the company and the device, want you to know that a Zamboni did not catch on fire. This is something I didn't know about. So what happened? Did a Zamboni actually catch on fire?
Well, an ice resurfacing machine caught on fire. And so this is the first time that I've learned that like the machine itself is just called an ice resurfacing machine and not a Zamboni.
Okay, you learn something every day. I thought that was like a general term.
Yeah. So in Brighton, New York, this video went viral earlier this week, kind of as a, like, this is 2020 in a nutshell. But it was an ice resurfacing machine driving around on the ice first with like these red streaks coming out from underneath it. So I thought like it ran over a child or something and that was blood. That's what it looked like. I guess my mind went to a really dark place there, but but then after that, the machine itself caught on fire and kind of kept driving, and the driver drove it off the ice and then they put the fire out. But yeah, just the shots of this machine that you typically see in a very cold place that is there to resurface ice and make it look really nice and shiny. Mm-hmm. you know, just catching on fire in the middle of an ice rink is a sight that has not been seen in a long time. And now that we have video of it, you can find that in the show notes. But it was, you know, since everybody thinks of those machines as Zambonis, because that brand is so ubiquitous, everybody is now talking about, oh, a Zamboni caught on fire. There's even articles out there saying like a Zamboni caught on fire, and that's resulted in the Zamboni company saying, no, that was not our machine. Our machine did not catch on fire. Our hydraulic hose did not break and leak on the motor, causing a fire. It was somebody else's machine. They didn't name that company, but it was not a Zamboni machine. Please stop calling it a Zamboni. Thank you to everybody else who has been pointing out that it is not a Zamboni. It is just a different brand of ice resurfacing machine. So I think this is just one of those problems that happens where when your brand becomes so ubiquitous that anything bad that happens with it, with any device made by anybody who tries to do the same thing, when even if it's your competitor, anything that goes wrong kind of gets blamed on you.
Yeah.
It kind of reminds me of when the NFL started using Microsoft Surface tablets.
And, yes.
The announcers kept calling them iPads. And then you'd see like the coaches on the sidelines just getting mad at them. And like even Bill Belichick, I think, threw one. And meanwhile, the Microsoft hated it because they couldn't get the announcers to stop calling them iPads and they couldn't get their brand out there. And then I think Apple hated it because they kept getting blamed for problems with Microsoft's product. So it's branding and advertising still matters in sports. There's a lot of money involved there. So in this case, Zamboni wanted to set the record straight that was not their machine that caught on fire. But shout out to the driver, Jordan Curtis, who, despite there being a massive fire around him, managed to drive this thing off the ice.
That is crazy. Like, he just kind of like scooted over a little bit more, like, and just drove it off. I just kind of, it was weird, right? Because it starts to definitely have some strong liquid coming out from under it. And he's like kind of still going, which I feel like you would just stop, right? Like if you saw that much of a streak of something coming out from under the machine, I feel like you would just stop. But
yeah, everybody picturing themselves in this situation pictures themselves bailing on the ice, just like hop off and just let the fire burn itself out.
Well, no, I just mean like it comes out, right? Starts to go down the ice. You see the red streak come out from under it. He looks at it. He kind of goes for that pass. It comes back around and it's like full on fire. Like, I feel like as soon as I saw something coming out from under it, that would have been my like stop and check it kind of thing.
Yeah. But he was just determined, like, we can't have this on the ice. So instead of kind of leaving it on the ice and letting somebody else deal with it, he took it off the ice and then helped put the fire out. Yeah. So Jordan Curtis is the hero of the day in this situation, who prevented a bad situation from getting worse and it went viral in the process. So good for him.
But stop blaming Zamboni. I think that's the big...
Yeah, don't blame Zamboni for any of this. That was not their machine. No.
Blame LeBron and the Lakers.
Yeah. All right.
I just had to throw that in.
The man gets enough hate.
He's been doing
this for 17 years. He's had expectations, monumental expectations, since he was a high school kid. And he's more than lived up to them. So give the guy a break.
I'm going to say this. I will say this as a basketball fan. The way I work is I tend to just you know, as a Knicks fan, there's just a lot of dislike that I have for a lot of people. When you know what? GGM called me a hater, and that's exactly what I am. When Jordan played, I had a strong dislike for Jordan. When he retired, I respected that man. When Kobe played, I had a strong dislike for that man, mostly because he played for the Lakers, and then when he retired, I had a strong like for that man. I have said this again, and I will say it again every single time. I like LeBron as a human. I think he does a lot of good things for the sport of basketball, but until his days of playing basketball are over, fuck that guy.
I think I said before, this is the most likable Lakers team in a long time, which still isn't saying much, but it's, I don't know, congratulations, I guess. Begrudging congratulations to them, and I'm not looking forward to having to deal with this team for the next 4 years or so. But
well, I want to congratulate Kentavious Caldwell-Pope. And remind everybody that he was another Joe Dumars draft pick.
Avery Bradley is another former Piston who got their first championship. Dwight Howard is a champion now, so congratulations.
Yeah, that's weird.
Kostas Antetokounmpo won a championship before his brother did. Dion Waiters, who got kicked off the Miami Heat after an incident with some questionable gummies, would have won a championship ring no matter what the result of this series was. So I guess congratulations to him for positioning himself that way. assistant coach Jason Kidd, who didn't have the greatest coaching record up until this point. All right. Thank you everybody for listening. This has been another fine episode of Sports Odds and Ends. Head on over to sportsoddsandends.com if you want to check out the show notes, if you want to watch a non-Zamboni catch fire in the middle of the ice, or read some of the other more meatier articles that we have. Especially check out the financial ones, because there's like a ton of details that we kind of skipped over. And then the analytics ones, there's a lot of talk about, you know, the legacy that both Daryl Morey and Billy Beane had. So check those out. Patreon.com/sportsoddsandends if you want to support the show financially. Thank you to those of you who do that already. Twitch.tv/JVZ if you want to catch us live every Sunday at 2 p.m. Eastern. If you want to hit us up on Twitter, I'm at JVZ. Kaz is at King Kaz. DGM is at Call Me DGM. At Sports Odds Ends is the Twitter account. Hit us up there. If you want to chat about anything related to sports or send us highlights and stuff, we love retweeting sports clips throughout the week, or at least I do. Hit me up for that. Thank you all for listening. We'll see you next time.